Hello, my name is Philip Mirton, and today we are going to have a conversation beyond science and religion.
Breaking new ground in thinking, exploring the outer limits of what we know about the world and ourselves, unhindered by common beliefs and perceptions. This is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, taking on subjects from the Big Bang, the multiverse, and evolution to the supernatural and the new rising consciousness. This is where scientists, philosophers, New Agers, and spiritualists come together to discuss where this world may be heading. Now, here's your host, lawyer, philosopher, and the author of The Heaven at the End of Science, Philip Mirton.
Now, as I've said, one of the purposes of this show is to bring the big questions down to earth, to break through the common beliefs and perceptions, to tell us how to think about the world and ourselves. Now, one of these beliefs that many of us hold is that the big questions, who we are, where the world is heading, and the meaning of life, to name a few, are somehow off limits or the province of only a few. Perhaps many of us say we don't have time to consider them, or they're too deep, or they're only for philosophy students and professors. But when you think about it, many of these big questions are not all that difficult, and I think that the truth of the matter is that many of us ponder them, but we ponder them silently. We don't verbalize our thoughts, our ideas about the big questions. And so on this show, we are going to probably approach the top three big question of all time, and this question is the meaning of life. Now, in preparing for the show, in recording them, I use this program called Audacity, and Audacity is a recording program where you could zoom in or zoom out on the recording, and if you zoom out, then an hour show could maybe take the space of about a millimeter, if you want to, or you could zoom way in, and where the show will be spread off to about 3 or 4 feet of recording. And in many ways, our lives are like this, and that is we get lost in the details, and we don't start looking back over the big picture until maybe we get older. And since we all do get older, it's somehow, I think, helpful for us to consider these big questions as soon as possible, because I think that the sooner we look for meaning, the more we might find it, and the more we might lead a meaningful life. Now, on today's show, we're very lucky to have as our guest Professor Jay Garfield. Now, Professor Jay Garfield is the Doris Silber Professor in the Humanities and Professor of Philosophy at Smith College. He also teaches philosophy at the University of Massachusetts, Melbourne University, and India's Central University of Tibetan Studies. Professor Garfield is the author and co-author or co-editor of about 16 books, including The Oxford Handbook of World Philosophy and Buddhist Philosophy, Essential Readings. And last but not least, he's also the professor, the host of a course on Great Courses series entitled The Meaning of Life, Perspectives from the World's Great Intellectual Traditions. So today we're going to be dealing with this question, the meaning of life, with somebody who put together 36 lectures on this topic, and I hope that we will all find this a useful conversation. Welcome to the show, Jay. It's nice having you.
Thanks very much. It's wonderful to be here.
Okay, so we've picked out a big question here, but it's like any big question, I think, or any big problem. You break it down into pieces, and you sort of try to deal with it in pieces, perhaps. But since you've, as I said, you spent 36 lectures on this topic, and so why don't you help us understand from your perspective what you believe is a good framework to approach this question about the meaning of life?
That's a good question. One thing that I would say is that if we look at the history of human thought, people have addressed this question in dozens of different ways and have addressed it fruitfully in dozens of different ways. So one of the first things I would say is there's no single approach to thinking about the meaning of life that's necessarily a whole lot better than any other. Yeah. So there are certainly some that have been proven useful. One thing that I think that almost every approach to thinking about the meaning of life has in common is that it begins with a certain kind of anxiety or problem. and the anxiety or problem concerns human finitude, concerns the microscopic nature of our own lives when we compare them to the vastness of space and time, or even the vastness of human history. It's hard when you think about your own life, if you think about it seriously, not to be struck by that fact, and then not to wonder whether something that's so short, but so ephemeral, but so localized in time and space, could be significant enough to care about. Nonetheless, we find ourselves compelled to care about our own lives, and it would be nice to figure out a way to make that rational. So almost every approach to the meaning of life with which I'm familiar begins by trying to understand what the connection is between our very finite and very constrained lives and structures or stretches of the cosmos that are much faster than that. How do we fit into the big picture? And I think that as we begin to think about what the big picture is into which we want to fit and how we can fit into that big picture, we can come closer to answering that question in a way that can be satisfying.
I think that, you know, what you said is really important, because each of us lives in a context, in a worldview, and maybe we're people of the times. And if you go back 2,000 years or 1,500 years to the time of the Buddha, the time of Muhammad or Socrates, the Stoics, as you say, the old-time thinkers, you know, they lived in their own social milieu, social context. And in today's world, I think we're seeing, you know, a stretching of our worldview, or a stretching of possibilities. And I think that changes, in my own view, I think that changes the question of the meaning of life, because as you say, and I think it's exactly right, which is that we're looking for our role in the big picture. But you got to define the big picture, right? And example, I read a lot of science books, many of which, for example, say that we're merely stardust. Okay, we're merely random creatures, or if you read Richard Dawkins, we're survival machines. So we're just cogs in a wheel. But in each one of those stories, the author or Dawkins or science has sort of drawn the big picture. And so I think it's very important, I think, for somebody approaching this question to sort of, you know, you're writing your own story, but I think you've got to keep open possibilities. Let's talk a little bit about your students, because you have the advantage of talking to a lot of people about this topic. What approach has worked with your students, or with the people that you have talked with over this topic of the meaning of life? What resonates with them in helping guide them to an answer, or at least to deal with the question?
Okay, I'll address that question, but let me first address something that you said a little bit earlier that I'd like to take issue with, if that's okay.
Sure.
You said that you thought that the question about the meaning of life must change dramatically in the 21st century and isn't anymore the same question that would have been asked by the Stoics or asked by the early Buddhists and so forth, because the context in which we live is different. I actually would like to take issue with that a little bit.
Sure.
I think that when we look at our lives, if we look at them in an inquiring way, we find that we lead our lives in multiple contexts. You're right to point out to the context of biology or the context of cosmology, but we also lead our lives in social contexts. We lead our lives in contexts of communities of value, and we lead our lives in the context of human history as a whole. And a lot of that was just as true 2,500 years ago when the Buddha lived, or 1,500 years ago when Muhammad lived, as it is now. And so in that sense, the details of our understanding of the context certainly changes over time. The context to which we end up referring our existence are strikingly constant over time. And they're also multiple. So when Dawkins focuses exclusively on a biological context, and argues that religion is dispensable because it ignores the biological context, he's focusing too much on one dimension of our embeddedness. When somebody focuses exclusively on a social context, then she's ignoring other kinds of value context, physical context, temporal context. So I think that when you look at the multiplicity of contexts, even though what we know about them or what we believe about them changes over time, it's remarkable how similar the questions are that we can ask now to those that were asked thousands of years ago. And that's important to me because the way that I like to approach asking about the meaning of life on my own and with my students, so now I am coming around to your question,
that was
finally,
good. Yeah.
Is through textual traditions, is by reaching back and asking what people have said, what people have asked, how people have thought in a variety of different social milieu, in different religious traditions, in different philosophical traditions. Because I think that by looking at these multiple perspectives, we gain a lot more insight. Sometimes when you're so embedded in your own historical context, your own historical matrix, and the presuppositions and the questions that that forces upon you, you fail to kind of lift your eyes to the horizon, and you fail to understand both its particularity and specificity, so that you don't look beyond it to look to broader questions, but also you fail to understand the degree to which, while it might feel unique to you, and you might say, my gosh, we live in these incredibly complex times, that everybody's lived in incredibly complex times. When you say we live in a time of so much change, everybody in human history has lived in times of change. We live in a time of so much uncertainty. Everybody's lived in times of uncertainty. And so for that reason, if we take a look back to see how reflection that has been undertaken in past times that bear relevant similarities to ours has gone, we can sometimes gain insight into our own lives and into our own times that we can't get just by remaining mired in the details and unable to see the big picture. So with my students, my approach is always, let's read. Let's look at texts. Let's see what Aristotle said. Let's wonder what we can make of it. Let's see what's in the Bhagavad Gita. Let's see what we can make of it. But let's not read every text assuming either that it's an oracle, that everything that it says has to be either true or something that's relevant to us, but nor do we read these texts assuming that because they were written by people in different cultures or at different times, that they're purely of historical interest. The reason that they've hung around in traditions of human is that they're of remarkably perennial interest. And if we can understand how that those perennial values that they express, the perennial questions they ask, and the perennial insights they develop are relevant to our own context, we can learn quite a lot. When I first developed this course, the Meaning of Life course, I actually developed it when I was teaching at the University of Tasmania in Australia. And I must say I developed it as a kind of cheap way of boosting student enrollments. I'm being a little bit self-deprecatory, I guess, but the idea was this. When you look at the way philosophy is often taught, students come to philosophy thinking that that's the discipline that allows them to ask big questions, that allows them to really wrestle with their concerns. And then very often they find that it's taught as a kind of mindless analysis of arguments or an inquiry into minutiae that they never really cared about, that professional philosophers end up caring about, but don't really resonate with students. And I really developed this course to show students that you can ask big questions. And you can ask them rigorously, you can ask them carefully, you can think them through, and that you're not the first person to have asked them. That you can think through in conversation with some of the greatest thinkers in human history, and that thinking them through isn't a kind of narcissistic activity where you just kind of sit in your room and wonder what you yourself think, but is in fact a rich dialogue that crosses time, crosses space, crosses traditions, and allows you to develop an appreciation for the scope of human thought. And it's proven to be a wonderful way to introduce students to philosophy.
Yeah.
And I still enjoy teaching this course.
I think that the one thing about the question about the meaning of life is that it's almost impossible to avoid. I mean, we could, there's plenty of other big questions, such as, you know, how the world was created or where the world is heading. But the meaning of life is something that it's hard to avoid, because at some point of each of our lives, I think we ask ourselves the question, you know, what am I doing here? What is my meaning? What is my role? What is my purpose? And so that's why I would agree. I think of all the big questions, it's something that you cannot avoid, because it is your own being, it's your own existence that is in question. Now, just to sort of loop back to this context question, and you know, and perhaps we don't see eye to eye on this, but in my view, over time, I think I would be called an optimist, or an idealist, but I do think that humankind gains a greater understanding of their our world, and we could talk about the scientific revolution, the quantum theory, cosmology, the new age advances, the attempts to combine science and spirituality, all these things where I think over time the whole purpose of science to me is to understand the world we live in. And so I don't, even though I would agree that the framework probably remains constant, I do think that the question of what is the meaning of life is sort of a moving picture. The landscape is changing as we understand the world we live in more. That's sort of what that's the point I'm trying to make. And maybe I didn't make it that great, but so for example, I think the Buddha, and I know you've done a lot of work on the Buddha. I think Buddhism is one of the best sort of interpretations of how you approach a world, a life where all things die away, and you're looking for something permanent, something firm to hold on to, something real. And so the Buddha believed that all is changing, that life is a river flow, and that he found that the secret was not to be attached to the physical material world, and I'm sure you could put that better than I just did, but my point being that he, I don't know how old it is, but that's like 15 years old now, 1500 years old, but it's still it still rings true. It still rings true, and I think that's why there's so many Buddhists in the modern world. There's a certain amount of eternal or perennial truth to Buddhism. So in any event, it's your turn. Why don't you comment upon? I mean, I think that we're not going to have time to go through all these great thinkers who sort of charted territory on this question. But why don't you comment upon Buddha for a moment, and what you see or how you see the Buddhist teachings as relevant for today on this question.
That's a nice example. And so once again, when we look at the Buddhist world, we look at a tradition of reflection on the nature of human life, the nature of existence, and what makes that human life worthwhile. And it's worth pointing out that, as you yourself did, that it's a tradition of reflection that begins with the person who's generally referred to as the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, who lived about 2,500 years ago, but continues right up to the present day and will undoubtedly continue into the future. So when we look at the Buddhist tradition, we're looking at a living tradition, and we're also looking at an extraordinarily diverse tradition. So we've got a number of different Buddhist thinkers who develop different insights, different approaches to thinking about life. But you're right that when we look to the beginning, we see a number of fundamental ideas that that informed Buddhism and turned out to have a very strong grip on the imagination and a very strong grip on reality, as well as a tendency to liberate us from certain dysfunctional ways of taking up with the world, and so making our lives more meaningful. Remember, that when we asked the question of the meaning of life, you yourself said a few minutes ago that everybody asks that question at some point. Actually, I think that's all overly optimistic. The people who ask that question are the people who have meaningful lives. A sure way of knowing that a life is not doing very much is when the question isn't even posed. What Buddha's thought does is urges us to pose that question, but gives us ways of making our lives more meaningful through posing it and answering it. So you focused on the issue of impermanence in Buddhism, and impermanence is one of the central insights with which Buddhism begins. But it begins at a more fundamental insight, because Buddhism is really about solving a fundamental problem that makes life look as though it's completely meaningless and completely and worthy of rejection. And that is the insight that's developed in what's usually called the first of the Four Noble Truths, that the entire world is permeated by suffering. And that's a deep philosophical insight. When you look at the world, you notice that people get old, they die, often very painfully, they develop dementia, there's starvation in the world, there's inequality in the world, there are horrible diseases, there's cold and there's heat. Any place you look, there's suffering. And if you're foolish enough to think that life is really pretty good, if you find yourself lying on the right beach or sailing on the right yacht, then you're forgetting the fact that that itself is impermanent, that you are headed for pain and suffering, and that other people in the world are suffering right now. And if you don't care about them, you're suffering from being a kind of egocentric asshole, to use a technical term. So suffering is ubiquitous. And for Buddhists, that sets the problem. The problem is, what do you do about suffering? And the Buddhist path is the path to transforming our awareness of suffering into a commitment to make the world better and to make our own lives better, to transform suffering into happiness, suffering into satisfaction. And that transformation involves a different way of seeing reality. And part of that is to not see ourselves as independent atoms, independent egos that stand over and against a world that's completely alien to us, but rather to see ourselves as part of a world of complete causal interdependence, to understand the fact that our lives are completely implicated with those of our parents, our children, our friends, our fellows, the environment in which we live, the sources of food that we have, the political systems with which we engage, and that the only way that our lives gain meaning is through contribution to the wealth of others. Shantideva, an important 9th century Buddhist ethical thinker in India, said, you know, when you look at the world, you see there are so many others and only one me. If I live for myself, my life means absolutely nothing. But if I live for countless others, then my life can have some significance. And so what Buddhism does through this insight into a fundamental problem that we all face, but also through into the solubility of that problem, through a recognition of interdependence, and through a cultivation of a sensibility often translated as compassion, the Sanskrit word karuna, but really means a commitment to act altruistically for others, and a recognition that when we can develop that commitment, we don't only benefit others, we benefit ourselves. We become better people, we become happier people, we become people who understand what the structure and the meaning of our own lives are. So, you know, again, I say that that was true 2,500 years ago when the Buddha developed these ideas. That's true now. When we confront the world right now, we confront a world permeated by suffering and a world of impermanence and a world of interdependence and a world that offers us the opportunity for determined compassionate engagement. And that's just as true now as it was then. And that's why Buddhism still flourishes now.
Yeah, I think one of the most compelling messages you give in your lectures when you're trying, I think you say it a couple of times, and I think you say it when you're summarizing the lectures, is that one of the perspectives in approaching the meaning of life issue is that we all look to figure out our relationship to something bigger. We point to some grander, whether it's a spirit, whether it's the universe, whether it's Mother Earth, whether it's a family, a clan, or whatever. And when you think about it, that is one definition of meaning, right? I mean, I think that's what you're sort of saying. You're saying, we always tend to define the little in terms of something bigger, or define a part in the context of a whole. You know, when you were saying that, I was thinking of that, of the making of the Oxford Dictionary. There's that, The Madman and the Professor, I think it's called. The making of the Oxford Dictionary, where words themselves were given meaning by context. They weren't dropped from the sky. The definition of altruism didn't drop from the sky. It gained meaning from the way it was used. And so with Buddhism, you know, I think it seems like what you're saying is that when all else is said and done, you could fall back upon the belief or the perspective that we are part of something bigger, that we are contributing to some kind of evolution, some kind of flow. I don't know what word makes sense. I don't know whether, for example, some Buddhists believe that there's going to be a point in time when everyone's going to be in nirvana, or whether there's going to be some kind of, I forget what the whether Buddhism actually has some kind of, you know, end point. But it does give you meaning to think that we are part of something larger rather than just grains in the sand that will be swept away in the wind someday. So I do think that perspective is a really good one. Now I have to say that when you add in reincarnation to Buddhism, and I don't know whether you believe in reincarnation or what your views are on that, but that is part of Buddhism. Is that right? The whole concept of reincarnation.
True that many Buddhists are committed to a view of rebirth.
Right.
And we get technical right now because you really have to talk about rebirth rather than reincarnation when you move to a Buddhist context. But the point that I want to make is not that that's important, but that there are Buddhist traditions in which rebirth is important, and there are Buddhist traditions in which rebirth just doesn't figure at all.
Yeah.
And it's an open matter of debate within Buddhist communities in the West, for instance, whether you need to hold on to a doctrine of rebirth in Buddhism at all. When you look at South Asian traditions and Southeast Asian traditions, that is the traditions that are dominant in India, Tibet, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, rebirth plays a big part. When you look at the Northern and East Asian traditions, the traditions of China, Korea, and Japan, it hardly gets a mention. And there are many scholars who would argue that rebirth really is a cultural heritage that is inessential to the broader Buddhist picture, while there are others who would argue that it's rather central. That's just one of the debates within Buddhism. My own view is that if you're looking at the Buddhist account of what makes our lives meaningful and of what sets the problem of the meaning of life, the problem is set by suffering. The solution is set through interdependence, an understanding of interdependence, a lack of ego grasping, and an altruistic commitment to acting for the welfare of others, and an awareness and acceptance of our own impermanence. I think that's really important. the idea of rebirth just plain doesn't figure in any of that.
Yeah.
To the degree that it figures in the Buddhist world, it's going to figure in other places and in other ways. But at this level, it doesn't really figure at all. So I don't think it's a big issue.
Now, that's interesting. Because I think that, and I mean, one of the things that really sort of intrigues me is the Dalai Lama. And I know that you spent a lot of time talking about the Dalai Lama, and I assume you've met him or have read a lot of his books and so on. But the whole concept of the Dalai Lama is that he is the reincarnation of the last Dalai Lama, right? That's how he gets his sort of stature, right?
Yep, the Dalai Lama lineage, like many Tibetan lineages, is a rebirth lineage.
Yes.
Rebirth is a very big role in Tibetan culture.
Yes.
The fact that it plays a big role in Tibetan culture doesn't mean it needs to play a big role in all cultures,
yeah.
or in particular in our culture.
Yeah.
Even if there's a lot that we could learn from the Tibetan tradition, it doesn't mean we have to learn, take everything from the Tibetan tradition.
Yeah.
Now, it's certainly true that most Tibetans, and indeed many non-Tibetans, regard His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama as the rebirth of the 13th Dalai Lama, and so on back to the first.
Right.
But he's a very prominent philosopher and scholar.
Yes.
He's the author of dozens of books, and he gives many talks and teachings, as you undoubtedly know. And in order to appreciate the depth of his insights and the subtlety of his arguments, you don't have to believe that he is a reincarnate Lama. If that helps you to appreciate it, fine.
Right.
But lots of people in the world who have no time at all for a doctrine of rebirth are nonetheless impressed with the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
Until
yes.
I would just set that question aside in taking up with his own views. Now, having said that, it's also worth pointing out in intellectual honesty that the Dalai Lama believes deeply in the doctrine of rebirth. But again, the fact that he believes that doesn't make it true and doesn't mean that it's one of the most important things you should take away from his own views.
I don't think there's any doubt that the Dalai Lama would have the same stature he does now, whether he's reincarnated or not. I mean, I completely agree with you. I mean, he stands on his own, and I don't think the fact that he may or may not be a reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama would really add materially to who he is. So I would completely agree. I think that from my perspective, and the reason I raise this reincarnation question is that as we're trying to draw this larger context of meaning that we are associating ourselves with or relating ourselves to, if one of those larger contexts is a worldview in which reincarnation does exist, it does I think affect your attitude, or can affect your attitude. It can affect the meaning that you give your own life, because you are trying to improve your future rebirth.
Let me give you another perspective on that. When you think that way, then you're thinking, gee, my life right now is important because of who I will be maybe in my next birth, maybe in 100 years, 200 years, whatever.
Right.
To the degree that you do that, you're still focusing on what we call in the Buddhist tradition ego grasping. You're still focusing on I next birth, I two births down the road, I in the future. But in order to care about the future, and in order to see your life in relation to the future, you don't have to posit yourself there. So I want you to imagine for a moment that you were living in medieval Europe, and you were a craftsman working on one of the great cathedrals that was going to take 200 or 300 years to build. And you're there at the beginning. Maybe you're carving stones that are part of the stairway or the bottom, the floor at the bottom. And you're saying to yourself, gee, I won't be around when this cathedral is done, but my great-great-great-grandchildren will, and this community won't be around, but our descendants will. And what I'm doing now is meaningful, not because I'm ever going to see the results, not because I will ever enjoy the finished product, but because there will be results. There will be a finished product. There will be people who will take joy in that. That's a reasonable kind of aspiration to the future that doesn't involve any kind of ego involvement and doesn't require me to be reborn to see the steeple constructed. It's like that when we work in science all the time. None of us thinks, if we're working in a laboratory, that we are going to finish the project of biology or the project of chemistry or the project of physics. Nonetheless, our own experiments, our own arguments, our own papers are going to be instrumental in advancing the whole affair. And we gain meaning through that. So I think that when anybody says that rebirth gives a special kind of meaning to life, I actually think it's quite dangerous, because then you begin to think that the meaning that accrues to your life is a meaning only in virtue of your own future existence. And that closes the horizons down again. I'm a teacher. That's what I do for a living. That's what my life is about. And why do I find my life meaningful? I find my life meaningful because I think that I have some impact on my students, and that they will have impact on their students, and they will have impact on their students. And I won't live to see or to enjoy the fruits of my great-grandstudents. But if that stuff in the future that makes my life meaningful now, and I don't need to be reborn to see it in order for it to be important for my life now.
Yeah, I think that was a really good way of dealing with the question, because I think what you did there, and I think that's important for listeners, is that you probed and sort of defining where we might be in the world with impermanence, with temporary lives, with suffering, with a lot of bad things, but then sort of thinking about how each of our lives can still have meaning. It's something that takes some contemplation. And I think that's what gives this question value, and I think that's what gives it meaning. Is that, and I'm gonna do a segue now. I think it's gonna be to Nietzsche, but I want to focus on another big point that I think you raise, and that is the importance of everybody sort of writing their own story, of being authentic, of being real, and I don't think a lot of people have an appreciation for Nietzsche on this, or for whatever source you want to attribute it to. But I think that of all the messages that I think are important on this point, that it's something that we each have to do ourselves. And reading the great thinkers on this topic, I think A, it's inspiring. B, it gives you some ideas, and C, it sort of indicates, hey, I have had some of those thoughts myself, and so maybe I could do this myself. So why don't you? I'd like to have you talk about, and it does not necessarily have to be Nietzsche, but what other thinker from the past who's dealt with these questions do you think has most relevance for us today?
Well, I think quite a lot do. I'll start with Nietzsche, since you raised him. And you raised the question of authenticity that Nietzsche raises, and the question of creativity. Nietzsche urges us to see our lives as works of art, as things of beauty, and to see ourselves as authors of them, as creators. He really takes seriously the notion that we perform our lives, that we write our lives, and a life can be really boring, or a life can be really exciting. And one way of understanding what makes an authentic life, a life that we take responsibility for, that we author, that we try to make compelling is a better life that can then be of value and of use to other people. That is, you want other people to be able to look at your life and learn something from it, to look at your life and derive some joy from it. And that requires demonstrating some creativity in leading it. Now, of course, Nietzsche was a bit of an elitist. He didn't believe everybody could do that. But he did believe that that to live authentically is to strive to do that, to make of yourself something that's worthy of being on the world. I think that's a wonderful thing.
Yes.
I also think that when we look, you know, at the history of Western thought, we can work back a little bit. Surprisingly to me, my students, and remember, I teach students who are mostly between 18 and 22 years old, and indeed most of my students are women since I teach at a women's college. Surprisingly enough to me, the philosopher with whom most of them connect most immediately is Marcus Aurelius, an aging Roman emperor riding in a military camp in a swamp in northern Germany.
Wow.
And when I teach Marcus Aurelius, I was always surprised at the beginning that my students resonated so quickly, especially because Marcus Aurelius focuses so deeply on the issues of impermanence and ephemerality and finding beauty in impermanence and ephemerality, of not seeing the fact that we're going to die as a terrible tragedy, as though living forever was somehow the goal and would somehow constitute the good life, but of seeing the end of life as an organic part of life itself, something Nietzsche also cares deeply about. If you write a good story, it's got to have a good ending. And if you're thinking about your life being a meaningful life, you have to think hard about your death and how you're going to face death. Sogyal Rinpoche, a really prominent Buddhist scholar, always says that we lead our lives in order to prepare for one moment, and that's the moment of our death. And you want to be able to say at that moment, I don't have regrets. I did it the right way. This was a life worth living. You don't want to end up for Ivan Ilyich, in the death of Ivan Ilyich, coming to the end of your life and realizing that you can't reflectively endorse anything you did, anything that you cared about. You can't see anything you did as having any significance at all. And as Ivan Ilyich says, it wasn't the real thing. Somehow I'm at the end of it, and I never really lived.
Yeah.
That's the great tragedy, and that's why it really is important, I think, to think about our deaths constantly. That's something Marcus Aurelius reminds us of. Always be thinking about the fact that it is certain that you're going to die, that you're an impermanent object, and make sure that you make the most of the moments that you have and are constructing a story that's going to have a good ending when it ends. I think these are really valuable insights from very, very different figures, of course.
Yeah, and it definitely puts the pressure on you to know that there's an end point, and therefore that, in my mind at least, we should be constantly looking for meaning. And I think there's two concepts here that are related, or that relate to this problem. One of them is freedom, because many people, I don't think, have the freedom or believe they have the freedom to write their own story. That they live in societies, families, cultures, where they're sort of told what they are supposed to do, what they're supposed to believe in, what their meaning is, and I think we have to be lucky, or we have to be consider ourselves lucky to have the freedom to write our own story. And there's also the courage aspect here, which I think is also referenced in your courses. You have to have the courage to think for yourself, to write your own story. It's not just, you know, freedom doesn't mean anything really unless you have the courage to make use of it. And I do think that's one thing that we're, you know, living in the society we do, where freedom is a hallmark of the Western mind, that there really is nothing stopping anybody from rewriting their story, reinventing themselves, changing careers, going back to school, traveling. It really is a decision that each of us make on our own. Now it's ironic that Marcus Aurelius would be the selection of the folks at Smith College, but I guess he was, if I remember correctly, he was a very eloquent writer.
Gorgeous writer.
And so I think that may have something to do with it. So now, in terms of those who want to approach this question and take more time doing it, what kind of guides would you give somebody? And I'm going past this question about, well, it's sort of, you know, the meaning of life, it's a big question, we don't really ever deal with it. But people who really want to probe this further on their own time, what kind of advice would you have for them?
Well, I would say this. You spoke a moment ago about freedom and called it a kind of a gift. I call it a responsibility. That if you have the freedom to make something of your life, then you have a responsibility to make something of your life. Because there are people who don't have as much freedom as others. So if you've got it, you can't waste it. But to make something of your life requires that one lead one's life with a certain amount of self-consciousness and reflectivity. I think that the way that one takes a kind of initial gift of freedom and turns it into genuine human freedom, the kind of freedom that enables creativity, is by not getting trapped and constrained by reflexive responses to situations, where I don't mean just biological reflexes, but I mean psychological reflexes, cultural reflexes, rhetorical or political reflexes, when one reacts immediately without thinking, without reflecting. Reflectiveness is the key. Taking that pause, thinking, considering alternatives, that's the key to genuine freedom. And I honestly believe that one of the best ways to become reflective about one's own life and about the meaning of life is to open oneself through reading, through discussion, through listening, to as many voices, to as many cultural traditions as possible. If you grow up in, for instance, a narrow religious tradition, whether it's Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, whatever it is, your first responsibility is to move outside and to begin to open up your mind to other traditions. If you grow up in a secular, anti-religious tradition, then open yourself up to religious voices. If you grew up in a religious tradition, open yourself up to scientific and secular voices. If you've grown up in a very liberal household, listen to what conservatives have to say. If you've grown up in a conservative tradition, really pay attention to why people want social change or political change, what makes liberal and radical thought move the way that it does. If there are people who know form important touchstones for your culture, but whose work you haven't read and you think you've only got them by osmosis, then read them. So it's no accident that I teach the kinds of courses I do that involve a wide swath of the world's intellectual traditions, because I honestly think that it's only by really deliberately exposing yourself to that kind of variety that you can gain the freedom to move about intellectually and to think in a way that takes the responsibility seriously that freedom presents us.
Yeah, that's that. I would sort of add to that to say, I think what you're saying is that it's each of our responsibilities to understand the big picture, the context in which we live, the richness of the world, because it, going back to the original method or one of the ways to find meaning, which is our place in a bigger scheme of things, many of us don't take the time to look at the bigger scheme of things. As you say, breaking through these barriers, breaking through these sort of categories of thought that we're raised with, are limiting. And I think they limit the meaning that we ultimately find. And I I may have put that differently, but I think I'm saying the same thing you are, which is use the freedom that we have to explore the richness of the world, because in doing that, we're going to find greater meaning, because it's an unbelievably diverse world we live in.
Exactly right.
So one last thing, and that is, in addition to perhaps looking up your course on the Teaching Company website, and by the way, folks, this is not a commercial for the Teaching Company, although I am a big fan of this of the Teaching Company, but there, as I said, Professor Garfield has a course called The Meaning of Life that's available on CD and DVD. I think it's downloadable as well. In addition to perhaps learning more about this topic by checking out your course, are there a couple books out there that you would recommend that people who are trying to sort of put their toe in the water on this, that you would recommend they read or pick up?
Sure, and there are a lot of them in the books I discuss in the course. Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics is a wonderful place to start. The Marcus Aurelius Meditations is a wonderful place to start. John Fire Lamedeer's wonderful contemporary book, Lamedeer, Seeker of Visions,
wow,
is terrific, because most people who grow up in our culture, even though we grow up in North America, don't pay any attention to the thought of Native North American people. And Lamedeer is extraordinarily articulate, both about his own culture and as a very keen observer of white American culture. Mahatma Gandhi's Hind Swaraj, fascinating and very challenging book.
Yeah.
The Dalai Lama, we've mentioned him. His lovely book, Ethics for a New Millennium, is a wonderful ethical challenge and exploration of what ethical life means in the contemporary context. If you want something more literary, Tolstoy's Death of Ivan Ilyich, which some people see as profoundly depressing, but I see as a real wake-up call to thinking seriously about life, and a book that has remarkable optimism at the end. These are really all terrific books to read to begin with.
Yeah, that's great. And again, I think those books and many others are listed in the bibliography in the materials to his course. Well, I'd like to thank you for your time, Jay. It's been, I don't think we answered the question what the meaning of life is, but I think at least by addressing the question head on, I hope we've shown the listeners that there is a way to approach this question, that finding meaning in all of our lives is something that will do us all good, that there's a lot of great thinkers that have charted the territory that can inspire all of us in finding our own meaning. And perhaps we, at the end of the day, we might not find the ultimate meaning, but then again, we may find that the journey to uncover the meaning will itself give our lives greater purpose. This is Philip Merriton. This is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, and thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Conversations Beyond Science and Religion with Philip Merriton. To find out more about Philip and his new book, The Heaven at the End of Science, visit heavenattheendofscience.com.